everyone. I'm your host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. Thanks for listening, and please remember to subscribe for free today on your favorite platform. My guest today is Eddie Jones. He is the founding principal of Jones Studio, an award-winning architecture firm in Tempe, Arizona that designs residential, cultural, and educational projects. These range from museums, research facilities, performing arts centers, golf clubhouses, an NFL training facility, town halls, sports stadiums, and an entire college campus. The firm's group of architects, artists, and designers share a passion for creating powerful, sustainable spaces and a commitment to advancing the common good through their work. Jones Studio was founded in 1979, mere weeks after Eddie's 30th birthday. Welcome, Eddie.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be on your program, Andrea.
A lot of people, when they're little, they come up with ideas of what they want to become when they're all grown up. And in your particular case, you actually did it. Can you tell us the story of how the letter W in a 26-volume encyclopedia set your father purchased had a major influence on the trajectory of your life?
Fortunately, I was very curious as a young boy, and fortunately, I'm curious as an old man, too. But this Encyclopedia Britannica set that Dad bought from a door-to-door salesman in the 50s, the late 50s, was the entire knowledge base of the world at the time. You know, I was in the middle of the country, in the middle of the century, in the middle of the state, and everything else was somewhere else. So to, you know, sort of dive into these books of curiosity and images, and I don't think I was very good at reading at the time. I was so young. But I turned every single page in those 26 volumes over the course of a few months. Point, I got to the W's, which was the thinnest volume. WXYZ was combined into one thin book. And I got to Orville and Wilbur Wright, who we all know. And then there was this other guy named Frank Lloyd Wright that I had never heard of, wasn't that interested in. But there was a photograph, a very small, grainy, black and white photograph of what I did not know yet was one of the most famous houses in the world called Falling Water in Pennsylvania. Now, why that hit me like a lightning bolt, I'm not sure, but it probably had something to do with what I just said about being in the middle of everything. It was a very conventional childhood. I'll just put it that way. And I lived in a very conventional house. And here was something that I had never seen before. It might as well have been on a different planet. And I thought, people can live like that? You know, houses don't have to look like my house or my neighbor's house. And that was it. That was the spark. And then back in the 50s, there were, you know, women's magazines that my mother subscribed to, House Beautiful, The Red Book. Each issue, because it was sort of the post-war optimism and modernism were holding hands. And so each issue would publish a modern house, mostly in California, some in Arizona. They would show the floor plans and interior photographs and exterior photographs. So I found myself trying to match the photographs to the floor plans. I didn't even know it was called a floor plan, but I figured it out. And I guess I just had this inherent ability to study two-dimensional flat images in a three-dimensional imagination. It was early training, wasn't it? You know, for how to, you know, think like an architect. And then at some point, my parents said, well, you probably want to be an architect. And I go, okay. And I was able to, even from an early age, gear my education towards a creative future, taking drawing courses, taking advanced drawing courses, freehand drawing courses. And then when I was in junior high school, there was a mechanical drawing course. Now, mechanical drawing is a lost art. It requires tools, triangles, compasses, T-squares, all those things, pencils. And I still remember the first drawing, mechanical drawing I produced, the first technical drawing I produced. I couldn't believe I did it. It was like learning a language, and I was immediately proficient at this new language. And that joy has never left me. I continue to this day draw by hand. As a matter of fact, I interrupted myself to come down here to participate in this podcast because I was having a wonderful time, totally absorbed in a piece of paper and the graphite and the ink that goes goes along with it. The short answer is I found the joy in architecture very early, and I've never stopped practicing. I've never stopped enjoying it. I'm more hungry now than I was when I first received that 26-volume set of encyclopedias.
The way you just described that sounds like the creation process is very visceral for you.
Yes, it is. It's rewarding. It's fulfilling. It's even a place to hide, given how scary things just became a couple of weeks ago.
Your firm has won many awards over the years, but recently you won another very special award, which was being honored in Forbes' inaugural America's Top 200 Residential Architects list. That's fantastic.
I'm proud to say that in spite of all of the very large work we do that you were describing earlier, I still do houses. I welcome a residential client, and selfishly, I keep them for myself. And that's what I was working on upstairs. Was a house for Park City for a young man that I've known, you know, most of his life. The output of residential design and actual implementation is pretty small as compared to most of the people on that list. I was named by Architectural Digest, one of the top 100 architects, you know, residential architects some years ago. I don't know how those things happen, but I am very proud of my houses, I'll tell you that. They're always different. Why are they different? The clients are different, their needs are different, their budgets are different, and above all, their sites are different. And it's a pleasure, especially to be given the responsibility to design someone's home that's not in Arizona, you know, that's in a different climate where maybe it snows a lot, rains a lot, or, you know, has other factors that shape and help drive decisions, design decisions. I hate to brag, but we had our annual American Institute of Architects, Arizona, AIA, Design Awards Gala. And back in the early 2000s, they invented the Firm of the Year Award. And Jones Studio was the first recipient of the Firm of the Year in Arizona. And Saturday night, we became the first firm to get it a second time. All of us got up on stage hugging. It was emotional and a beautiful thing. You know, I swear I have the best people that exist in Arizona.
That's really, really great. Speaking of success, I read in an article where you attribute a lot of the firm's financial success to your brother, who also studied architecture, but who has the skills and the talents to run the business side of the firm while you focus on the design aspects.
Yes, my brother, Neil, he's been my partner for 40 years. We now have two younger partners who will succeed us. When we were kids, you know, we sort of daydreamed, fantasized about having our own firm, whatever the hell that meant. And Neil intuitively knew that he wasn't as strong in design, so somebody's going to have to run the business. So he was one of the first students at the University of Illinois to receive a double master's in their new program of double master's in business and architecture. And so when he joined Jones Studio, I think in 1983, Jones Studio, it was me in my third spare bedroom. I don't want to imply that I actually had a legitimate company. He came on board and he just methodically began to set up business practices. He was able to take advantage of a new system of public work, RFQs, requests for qualifications. Prior to that, as you might expect, the established architects in Phoenix, there were probably six or seven, got all the work. The leftovers, you know, that fell off the table, we were there to grab the crumbs. This new system was invented, which was great because Neil had been taught at a very large firm back in Atlanta how all of this marketing and how to present yourself could be effective. And so we came out of the gate batting 1,000 because we had an advantage. I have seen brilliant designers eventually fail because they were unable to accept the condition of business. And especially if you have payroll, then the weight on one's shoulders is great. And one has to, you know, respect the nature of business in order to continue to do good work.
So early in your career, before you and your brother joined forces, you were teaching at Arizona State University to supplement what you were earning as an architect in your spare bedroom. Years later, the firm designed several buildings on the ASU campus, like Abuse Center for Law and Society, which houses the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State, the ASU Thunderbird School of Global Management, and the Laddie F. Coor Hall, which houses several ASU schools and departments. What was it like to be there at the very beginning of your career, and then later on as part of a renowned firm?
I was compared to Mr. Magoo last week. You know, I go through life and everything's beautiful. Meanwhile, things are crashing down around me and I'm not even aware of it. So when I was young and teaching at ASU, honestly, I thought, I can remember saying to myself in my mind, I will never get to do a building on this campus. Gosh, that would have been such a thrill. The first two you talked about, the School of Law, we partnered with INEAD out of New York, and that is in downtown Phoenix. That's the ASU's downtown campus, as opposed to the Tempe campus. And right next to it is the Thunderbird School of Business, in which we were the lead architect on. And they're in downtown Phoenix, because I said the same thing. I will never get to do a building in downtown Phoenix. And here we now we have two we're associated with. And on the ASU campus, the Tempe campus, we have, gosh, we probably have 5-6 buildings we've done over the years. They were a very good client, especially in the beginning. And then there's a Polytech campus out east of town that we were probably the first architects to do work on, that old Air Force base that was converted to an ASU satellite campus. So the feeling, well, who would have thought? That's the feeling. Who would have thought?
They need to name a building after you now.
I don't think so. I already have, the building I'm in right now is named after me, Jones Studio.
Earlier this year, you wrote an op-ed in azcentral.com, the digital home of the Arizona Republic newspaper, in which you said, and I'm quoting here, "If we continue to make the border a security hot potato, ignoring the humanitarian reality and failing to upgrade our immigration system, we will continue electing people who feign outrage and perpetuate border confusion for their own self-interest. The southern border, like any border, should not be a thing that separates two countries. The border connects us." And then a month later, you wrote an op-ed in the Architect newspaper in which you said, quote, "What my colleagues and I have witnessed is in no way a security crisis, no caravans, no invasions, no surges, but the looping film footage showing hundreds of men, women, and children seeking a better life for their families is heartbreakingly real. Let us accurately acknowledge that this is a crisis of humanitarian suffering." What was the impetus to write these two articles, and what gave you the courage to do that, especially when this perspective isn't welcomed by everyone?
I snapped. That's a short answer. It was an election cycle. But I'll back up a little bit. These land ports of entry that we now... I think it's okay to say we specialize in. And our client is the General Services Administration, the branch of the federal government that oversees all of the federal properties. And the user of these land ports of entries is Customs and Border Protection, not to be confused with Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection, CBP for short. And we have a very good relationship with these officers. We're on our 7th land port of entry project right now. Oh, maybe... 6 or 7 months ago, I was down in San Luis, Arizona. It's the southwest corner, extreme southwest corner of Arizona, and there's a land port of entry. And we've done several projects there. Right now, we're under construction for rebuilding the entire port, modernizing the entire port. And the port director and I were outside, having taken a break from our meeting, you know, having a sandwich. And it was a beautiful day. You could hear birds singing and chirping. And meanwhile, it's a commercial port, so semis are coming and going. And I said to John, I said, "John, you know, all the years I've been coming down to the border fence and spending so much time at the border fence up and down across Arizona and Southern California, it's always peaceful. You know, you guys do a great job. And it's never talked about. You know, you never hear that on the 6 o'clock news. They always open with, and now we're going to talk about the border crisis." And I said, and I've never seen a crisis. Because that does need to be more talked about. And that's coming from the head guy, CBP, at this land port of entry. And so, we finished our sandwiches and did our meeting. And, I came home and I was sitting in my living room watching the 6 o'clock news. And one of the candidates came on with a campaign commercial. We were flooded with them, as you know. And she starts spewing her bullshit and about the border crisis. And like I said, I snapped. I couldn't take it anymore. So I decided to sit down and write what I thought was the truth. And I defy anyone to find an error in what I wrote. I thought people would be relieved to find out that there's not a border crisis or an invasion. And instead, I got lots of hate mail, which I still don't understand that mentality. I'd hoped the New York Times would run the article. They declined, but Arizona Republic picked it up, and so did USA Today. And NPR picked it up and interviewed me a couple of times. And so I felt good about having the exposure to give an alternative viewpoint. Whether people wanted to believe it or not is up to them. Although I got 80% hate mail, I did get 20% complimentary correspondence, which was good. In fact, I am surrounded by people that feel the same way I do about the border is what connects us as opposed to the separating us. And it's a useful attitude because it allows us to have an optimistic approach to designing these facilities, which have to reconcile the disparity between, the mandate from our government that says we need to respect and welcome people to America, and then we have to respect CBP's law enforcement requirements and personal inspection requirements. I think the reason Jones Studio keeps getting hired is we always endeavor, and with a pretty high degree of success, do reconcile those goals. And so everybody wins. And the more land ports we do, the more CBP sees that good design matters. It's measurable. The anxiety levels of people coming into America are a decrease, which decreases the anxiety levels of the officers. They feel safer. And, I don't think it's a surprise that if you recognize people's personal dignity and you show respect, that it matters. And so we continue to do it no matter who's in charge.
Probably the most famous port of entry that you've worked on is the Mariposa Land Port of Entry. In an interview in Architecture Magazine, you shared that you began the design process by reading the poem Borderlines by poet laureate Alberto Rios, who grew up in a border town in Arizona.
Yes, Nogales.
Why is this poem special to you, and how did it inform the design process?
I have long answers for everything. Forgive me. It starts with, how in the hell did we get our first land port of entry in the first place, which was Mariposa? We were a small company. We were like, maybe 11 people. And this is back in 2006, I think. Back up a little bit further. The General Services Administration established what they call Design Excellence Program around 1995, which was a result of Senator Patrick Moynihan, the senator from New York, recognizing that federal buildings were killing city blocks because, the mentality was this is taxpayer money, therefore these need to be the cheapest and most economical buildings. There can be no excessive fenestration, whatever. And they were dull and they were not pleasant to work in. And so he penned three design principles that continued to guide these projects today. And a land port of entry falls under the Design Excellence Program. So do federal courthouses and so do federal office buildings. And if you don't bring your A game as an architect, you can get fired. I have seen that happen to other architects. Part of this Design Excellence Program involves peer reviews. And I answered the phone one afternoon in, I think, 2004 and found out that I had been appointed a national peer reviewer for the Design Excellence Program. How that happened, I don't know, but I said yes. Didn't know what I was saying yes to, but it sounded pretty cool. And it was. And my first assignments happened to be land ports of entry in Texas. So I would sit in these meetings as a peer reviewer, learning what land ports of entry were all about. So when the RFQ came out, the request for qualifications from the General Services Administration, I said to my brother Neil, I think we should go after this. Mariposa posts a land port of entry. He goes, "You're crazy. We don't have any experience. We haven't designed a ticket booth, much less an inspection booth." I go, "I don't know, Neil. I think we should try it." He goes, "Okay, let's try it." So part of my research and the narrative that I wrote to hope to get shortlisted for this project was that I knew Alberto Rios. I knew he had grown up in the area. So I was able to read a book he wrote about that experience of growing up in Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Sonora, and interview him and learn about the history, you know, really the backstory, that to learn about the Ambos Nogales. That is the ambient Nogales. All border towns have this ambient quality. And the irony is, you know, they fill up with tourists and they swell, their populations swell to 100,000 on the weekends, and then they shrink back down during the week. And ironically, most policy is written for the Ambos condition. Anyway, I was able to write very sincerely, perhaps even poetically, about this unique quality of a border town, and especially the unique qualities of Nogales. And we got shortlisted. We were shortlisted with four other architects. All have had experience in working for the government. But Jones Studio was the only firm in Arizona to get shortlisted. So long story short, we did our interview in San Francisco. We talked about the white light of the Sonoran Desert. We talked about water shortages. We talked about, you know, saguaro cactus and this and that. We got the job, which you really have to appreciate this design excellence program, because they make choices of architects based on potential as opposed to experience. That's almost unheard of. And then when you understand that these are $230 million projects, we're now doing $300 million projects. It's crazy, you know, that we got that job, but by golly, we delivered. And you notice in the last line of that poem, Alberto says, "Let us turn the map slowly until we see clearly. The border is what connects us, not what separates us." And we live by that. That is our guiding star through all of these land ports. We never forget that. And it makes all the difference in how we conceptualize initially what approach we're going to take.
Your firm's projects emphasize modernization over traditional barriers like barbed wire, for example, and each land port of entry you've designed also includes a garden. What purpose do these gardens serve, and what message do they send to those who pass through these spaces?
Well, you know, earlier I was saying, you know, when you recognize people's dignity and treat them with respect, then there are positive outcomes. And when I first arrived in Nogales to see the port that had been built in 1973, CBP valiantly was keeping up with the changing security protocols, a substantial increase in traffic, and also piecemealing new security systems. It was a very dangerous environment. And I don't mean, you know, from an immigration standpoint. I mean the dust and the heat and the fumes from the cars and the fumes from the trucks idling because it had become so inefficient. You know, there could be a 4-hour, 5-hour, 8-hour wait time. And I looked at this 50 acres of basically dirt and pavement and heat waves, you know, in the air. I didn't think about this place needs a more sufficient circulation system. I thought this place needs a garden. That is an absolute truth. The first thing that entered my mind. And we had a wonderful landscape architect, Chris Winters. He's a local too, who bought into the idea and has reinforced it every time. And then to your point about going against conventional security systems of barbed wire, we use the architecture to create safe spaces, to create perimeter and secure, you know, the 50 expanded 54 acres. You don't see coils of razor wire. You don't see strands of barbed wire. There is some, but it's kind of hidden. It drops below the top of the walls. And so what you read is an oasis. I couldn't change the mile on either side of the sort of desolate approach to the gateway to America. But once you enter into the compound, it's a huge difference. Instead of pedestrians and cars and bicycles fighting for the same space, it's all separated. People can feel like they're passing through nature into a crystalline building, this glassy, transparent building for pedestrian processing and then exiting underneath a beautiful sculpture and finally arriving in the United States. And that's what it's all about. We're very proud that we can do that. And I love that opportunity to keep doing it more and more. If you think Mariposa was good, wait till you see when San Luis, when it's finished. Working on the master plan for a brand new port. Finally, we have a clean piece of ground. We don't have to work around any existing, outdated, obsolete port. It's west of Douglas, Arizona.
So with Mexico as America's top trading partner, how vital are modernized land ports of entry to maintaining these strong cross-border relations and economic stability, particularly for border states like Arizona?
It's essential. Again, you don't hear that reported on the 6 o'clock news, but you know the border is a huge business, import-export business. All the noise you hear about illegal immigrants, I mean, it's such a tiny little piece, and all the drug smuggling and human trafficking. I don't want to sound insensitive, but it's a very small piece of what's really going on, and that is the business of import and export. And that's measured in the billions and billions of dollars every year. And so you can imagine, whenever you want to know, the real answer to any question, follow the money. And so you've got these produce brokers, especially bringing produce from South America, Central America, Mexico. They can access the interstate highway system through the land port at Nogales. And when there's that much money at stake, the brokers are not going to tolerate their drivers having to wait in line for 10 hours while the tomatoes rot in back. So, there's this incentive, as an understatement, to increase the throughput, minimize the wait time so these produce deliveries can take place in a timely manner. I mentioned San Luis. San Luis is located next to the Imperial Valley in Southern California. You have hundreds of thousands of acres of produce being grown, and you've got a year-round growing season. It's Arizona. So where does the water come from? It's an arid climate. Well, the Colorado River, as it snakes its way towards the Sea of Cortez, we suck all the water out of it to irrigate these fields of produce. It's been said 95% of the leafy greens consumed in the United States come from Southwest Arizona. Now, in order to plant and maintain and harvest these crops, you have to have a large labor force. Yuma doesn't have it. Little San Luis certainly doesn't have it. But San Luis Rio Colorado, across the border in Mexico, has the labor force. We had migrant farm workers getting up at 2-3 o'clock in the morning to stand in line so they could go through this inefficient processing in order to get to the fields on time. And then they returned every night home. I'm really proud to say that the wait times plummeted. GSA said, we want these workers to be able to spend more time with their families. Isn't that benevolent? I mean, when do you hear that coming from any governmental client? You ask anyone at Jones Studio, we'll say the same thing. Our best and most progressive client is the federal government, the GSA, General Services Administration. They have our back. They mandate that we introduce a garden, then they're going to give us the tools to make sure that that garden can thrive. And they're going to give us the tools to create architecture, not buildings, but architecture that serves both the visitors and Customs and Border Protection, and do it in an excellent way. And thanks to the Biden administration, the infrastructure bill and the Inflation Reduction Act, San Luis will be the first net zero land port of entry in the world.
Before we move on, I want to remind all of our listeners out there to subscribe to the podcast so you can continue enjoying hearing from wonderful guests like Eddie Jones. And next, I want to talk about one of your recent projects, the Monroe Street Abbey restoration. Can you tell us about that and how you approach the creative process when designing a space like that? Is it more driven by rational principles, emotional intuition, or a combination?
Always a combination. I said last Saturday we won the Firm of the Year award for the second time. We also won an honor award for the Abbey.
Oh my goodness.
If there was ever a labor of love, it was the Abbey. It was the first Baptist church in Phoenix, and the congregation outgrew it and ended up building a behemoth, you know, church further north. And the building went in and out of certain ownerships and came abandoned. And Terry Goddard, our former two-term mayor and attorney general, who loves historic architecture, bought the building. Vacant buildings in most urban areas sooner or later are going to be occupied. And somebody built a campfire on one of the floors, and the building caught on fire, and the entire roof over the sanctuary was destroyed and collapsed. That was 1987, I believe. And in 2011, Chris Winters, remember the landscape architect I said earlier, and another friend of mine, Michael Johnson, we decided we were going to find a project for a mutual friend, Herb Green, one of the best architects of the 20th century that nobody knows. Okay, he was in Norman, Oklahoma, taught at the University of Oklahoma under, you know, when Bruce Goff was the dean there. His niece, Leela Cohen, who was sort of became his manager, encouraged us to find a venue for his armature philosophy, which is, you know, you take a local building and you sort of, at least conceptually, give it over to the local artist to as an armature for their art. And so we spent the day looking around downtown Phoenix, warehouses, this and that. Nothing really sang to us. It was about time to start drinking beer. And Chris said, well, there's one more place I want to take you to see. And he took us to this old church, which was kind of a nondescript church. You never noticed it. It was beige. You couldn't really tell. It didn't have a roof because of the gable end was still intact. And it was boarded up, and we peeked through the cracks in the boards. We saw that nature did what she always does. She was reclaiming her property, and she had planted a garden inside this roofless sanctuary. I thought, a secret garden in downtown Phoenix. How cool is that? And so, you know, we all bought into the idea, and Chris, you know, started, and Leela started putting together a lookbook, kind of, you know, images of what this secret garden could be. And we pitched it to the owner, Terry Goddard. He had been pitched a lot by different developers and architects around town. Apparently, we hit the nail on the head, and we became his team. That was 2011. It's now almost 2025. So it is a long, long time. It had to do with tax credits and money. You know, Terry didn't have deep pockets. And so we just sort of trudged along. You can imagine what intense heat will do to interior surfaces. Rooms that were designed to be interior have been exterior for decades. Decades of exposure. Then there was the intense heat. And you get these beautiful discoloration and patterns on the plaster. And then you had the graffiti, you know, from people breaking into the building. It was so unique. Nobody is good enough to design those patterns the way Mother Nature and the laws of physics had designed them. And so the challenge became, how do we modernize this building to the point that it can be open to the public and not destroy its unique character? So it became a question of stabilization as opposed to repair. And it worked. And we were able to, you know, Maria Salinger, she was the project architect from Jones Studio, you know, just the surgical inclusion of a new door jamb, a new room in this old building was a remarkable achievement. If you've seen photographs, I think you'll agree. You step into a different world. You'd never know you were in downtown Phoenix, Arizona, fifth largest city in the United States. It's a very special respite.
Your firm is also designing the Water Education Center for Central Arizona Project, which is a 336-mile aqueduct system that delivers Colorado River water to almost 6 million people, which is more than 80% of Arizona's population. Can you share your vision for the project and how you hope this facility will influence public understanding of water resources and conservation?
Well, that's the goal of the building, and that's coming straight from the client. And I have to give credit to Brian Farley, Sterling and Sean Swisher. Brian's one of my new young partners, and Sean is a really gifted designer. This was a design competition put on by CAP. They asked two firms to come up with some conceptual ideas of what their new facility would be, because they already knew they lacked a connection to the community. They lacked the ability to communicate the important work they do. And why do they need to communicate the important work they do? Because everything is about funding, having community support. So it was a good reason to create a new facility. And they said, you know, here's the site by the canal, and here's, you know, where the parking lot's going to go. And maybe it would be a good idea to have a tower so people can climb the tower to actually see the canal. You hand Jones Studio a suite project like this involving the Arizona canals, which, by the way, we have more linear miles of canal than Amsterdam and Venice combined.
Is that true?
Nobody knows that.
Really?
But we're going to fix it.
That's amazing.
And really, that is a true statistic. And so for us, and Brian especially, it was a no-brainer. We can't put the building here where they want it. We're going to have to span the canal, be on top of the canal to completely integrate the message in with the actual physical object. And it's like, everybody's going to do this. Well, they didn't. The other firm didn't. They stuck to the rules, did the tower. And when they saw this building spanning the canal, it's like, that's it. You know, mic drop, you know, you guys get the job. And it's just gotten better and better. I watched the development of the design, and it's going to be one of our best projects ever, I can tell. But to have broken the rules, to blatantly ignore, you know, the instructions is something that Jones Studio does all the time, but not out of defiance, just out of seeing a better way. These land ports of entry, back to that, the GSA always gets a feasibility study. We are always handed a master plan, and we always throw it away. You know, the first time we did that, the whole team was just, oh my God, we're going to lose this job. I go, look, guys, this doesn't work. Let's fix it. The government's going to spend $15 million on this. And if it's worse, then it's a waste of time. So let's show them a better way. And they did it. And then the next one, it was less difficult to turn that ship. And then this last one, Douglas, they expected us to completely start over. When you speak in pragmatic terminology and point out how what appears to be an acceptable solution, how in the long term it grows into its own problem. Whereas if we do this instead, it avoids that inevitable choke point, so to speak.
Architecture plays a crucial role in climate resilience, especially as extreme weather events become more common. And in your view, I'm curious to hear what steps should be taken to support architects and builders committed to sustainable, resilient design.
This is going to sound self-serving, but I really believe that the education of an architect, regardless of the university, is the best education available to anybody in the world. Why? Because it teaches at the intersection of art and engineering. It connects both sides of the brain. It's all about objective problem solving, identifying problems and responding in a creative way. And I heard another architect say this, engineers, doctors, lawyers, they know everything about one thing, but architects know something about everything. And it's an asset, believe me. I say that, therefore, what steps can be taken? We need more architects running for mayor and governor. And then the step is to vote for them. Because, as I said, we are trained to solve problems objectively. I gave a lecture, it was a border lecture, at the Neutra Institute in Los Angeles about a month ago. And there was a national AIA gold medal winner in the audience, Angie Brooks and her husband, Larry Scarpa. And Angie came up to me after my lecture and says, you know, Eddie, design will save the world. And architects are in the best position to save the world. Great. More pressure. But I don't know. I think she's on to something.
So we need more architects in politics.
Yes, we do. Not me. I haven't learned how to poke the bull without pissing people off. So.
Well, I think you're doing your fair share to try to get people to think reasonably and to propose a holistic view of things. So you're doing your part as well.
Thank you.
You were talking about some of your younger colleagues and the use of digital tools, but you still create your renderings by hand. Can you tell us what you love about this tactile approach and how it impacts your creative process?
I'll try to describe the sensation. When I sit down at my drafting board, and if, in case you don't know what a drafting board is, it's a specialized desk with a tilted top and with tools attached to it and lamps and electric pencil sharpeners nearby. And I start drawing, I disappear. I go somewhere else. And it's just the paper, the pencil, my hand, and my brain. The pace of drawing is synchronized with the pace of one's thinking. And so as I draw, I'm thinking. And then the drawing at some point will take on a life of its own. It speaks to me through graphics and intensity and line weight. And when I put down a line, it takes an effort to get rid of it if it's wrong. So I want to be correct every time, but I'm not correct every time. So sometimes I have to erase. But when I erase, there's still an indention in the paper. And then as my hand moves across the paper, sometimes it drags the pencil line across and there's a smudge. And so when I'm done, there's this a history of my disappearance. You know, it's right there. Drawings are kind of magical. In a way, they're my secret weapon against competing with other firms that have all the, you know, the latest software to generate realistic renderings that are soulless. And to see a hand drawing, as human beings, we relate to that. And so not only do these drawings bring me joy, but they're also a very effective sales tool.
That's really beautiful. I like the way you describe that. I'm sure you probably have some thoughts about AI.
Well, I'm all for it. I may be an old man, but I've been around long enough to know that when something is here to stay, any tool can be abused. AI certainly has a danger attached to it, but it also has wonderful opportunities too. And it's going to be okay. Once we get through the cusp of the newness, it will be folded into our box of tools like the pencil was whatever turn of the century that was introduced.
Back in May, your firm posted a lovely mention about World Turtle Day 2024 on Facebook, where you shared a photo about your co-workers, Phineas, Timmy, and Ferb. Timmy, the most senior, is a desert turtle, and Phineas and Ferb are both African tortoises. And in the post, you wrote, "We pride ourselves on providing fair wages and a generous benefits package, including lettuce, apples, and other veggies and housing." And unfortunately, while Phineas is no longer with us physically, rest in peace, he's always with us in spirit. We recently held a poignant memorial service and interred him in a place of honor outside our studio while sharing our favorite memories of him. Tell us about these coworkers.
I just love them. They're so funny and witty. And that was all them. I don't even know where these turtles come from. I just come to work and there's another turtle. I just really enjoy the distraction that they bring to my young colleagues. And that is not atypical. Gosh, we just organized a pizza party for ourselves in our building. You know, we occupy a building that I designed, and it's only 6,500 square feet. And there's a parking lot outside, but it's not a typical parking lot. It's decomposed granite. That's the gravel that comes from the Sonoran Desert. And there are mesquite trees growing out of it and creating shade. And we can empty the cars out of that parking, so-called parking lot, and it becomes a pocket park. And we set up a long table and tablecloths, and we party our asses off. I mean, it is so much fun. I told somebody a long time ago, if I didn't own Jones Studio, I really would want to work here. You know, I would hope they would hire me because those guys, they really have a lot of fun. Shoot, they just went on a camping camping trip 2 weeks ago. Back in the day, we took trips to Mexico City to Blitz Architecture. Jacob and I and several other architects are going to the Middle East the first part of January to see architecture. It's a dynamic group of people, that's for sure. They keep me young.
I heard that the Basilica Sagrada Familia in Barcelona is your favorite building in the whole world. It's set to be completed in 2026 after more than 100 years. Do you already have plans to visit and experience the completed structure in person?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've probably been there 6 times in my life and spanning probably 25 years. I usually say I think it's the most beautiful building in the world. My favorite building in the world probably is whatever building I admire that I'm in at the moment. But the Sagrada Familia, it's gut-wrenching. I mean, architecture is taught in a very sort of linear, methodical way. You see buildings like the Sagrada Familia, and it can only come from somebody's gut, from their heart, because it's unprecedented. And when you think centuries ago how Antonio Gaudi communicated how to construct this elliptical shape by cutting, beveling an egg, or how to get these catenary curves by building a string sculpture and weighting it with little bags of sand and then putting a mirror underneath it. No computers, no software. And then the embellishment of tile and color and sparkle and light and stained glass. I mean, it's breathtaking. Beautiful. And I hope it's still as accessible as it was the first time I was there. I still remember climbing the spiral turrets and getting on some of those little bridges that connected the turrets together 300 feet up in the air and thinking, damn, I can't even believe this is legal. You know, you never get to do this in the United States. That's what I love about Europe. They'll let you go anywhere if you've got 4 euros.
Eddie, tell us how people can learn more about your work.
We have published 2 books. The first book I did during the pandemic when I had nothing else to do, and it was a book on my houses. I chose 14 diverse projects. You know, certainly, I wasn't trying to make a judgment of these are better than the other ones I've done. I just wanted to show a diversity of form and material and scale. And it's called Jones Studio Houses. It's available at Amazon. And then a more important book, I think, is the recent publication of Strive. And that's a more comprehensive view of Jones Studio, sort of the history of Jones Studio, where we've been, where we are now, and where we're going. We're very proud of that book.
Thank you so very much for having taken the time today.
My pleasure. You've been a delight to talk to.